Good morning, everybody. I would like to start off today by doing something I haven't done before, and I would like to dedicate my talk to Kaku Hoshi, my Dharma brother and teacher. He's always dedicating his talks to various people, and I've been thinking about him a lot, missing him up here. He had his first radiation treatment yesterday, and he's doing fine. But I just wanted to send him extra love. So, this session is feeling remarkably deep to me so far. I feel like we settled in much quicker than I'd experienced in the past, and it feels very powerful. I think that we can also thank the heat a little bit. It kind of puts us in a place where we just have to give up and just surrender to it. And there's also an auspicious element to this week coming up that maybe some of you are aware of. I'm pretty sure Seizan and Joshin Sensei are aware of this, but Friday is going to be a blue moon. It's going to be the second moon in the month, the second full moon in the month of July. So a blue moon is a very rare occurrence. It only happens about every 3 years. And this one is even more rare because the last time a blue moon happened in July, it was 2004. 11 years ago. Do you remember where you were 11 years ago? I think there were a few folks here today that were here 11 years ago. I think Seizan got Jukai that year, and I think Fugan was ordained. And back then, the village Zendo had one teacher, Enkyo Sensei. A little VZ history for you. I wasn't here that year. It was the year before I first came to the Grail. I had already been sitting with the village Zendo for a few years at that time. But I was never able to come to the Grail because of work that I was doing then. But in 2004, in that year, I really felt like I really wanted to experience a session. I had never been on a session before. I knew I wasn't going to be able to come to the Grail. So I spoke with Roshi about it, and I searched around, and I ended up signing up for a retreat at a Rinzai temple. Now, I was quite a younger man and was physically able to handle this retreat, but it was brutal. We woke up at 4 a.m. The last period ended at 10 p.m. Zazen periods were 45 and sometimes 60 minutes, and we had only 2 one-hour breaks in the day. Something I also remember was in the orientation, one of the head monks saying that pain was an illusion. So it was a lot of sitting, and at the end of the week, I was completely stoned from it. High as a kite, really like I was on drugs. And the high lasted for a couple days after the retreat, and then everything went back to normal. Now, that following winter, I did my first retreat with the village Zendo at Wisdom House. And when I arrived, I was scratching my head when I first saw the schedule. I was like, waking up at 5:30, there were several like 2.5 hour breaks, 30 minute periods of zazen, lights out at 9:30. I was like, what kind of jive BS Zen retreat is this? The village Zendo is soft, I thought. This isn't real Zen. But there was something different at that retreat. And by the end of that week, my robe and cushion were soaked with my tears. What was happening at that retreat was my heart was opening up. This is from the Gospel of Peace of Jesus Christ. Seek not the law in your scriptures, for the law is life, whereas the scripture is dead. For I tell you truly, all living things are nearer to God than the scripture, which is without life. At the Village Zendo, I found this life. Maybe some would look at it from the outside and say it wasn't real or authentic, but it breathed life. It was truly living, not just by the book. Now, I bring this up because it was interesting to hear Shinryu Sensei say in his talk that some people thought we should have more sitting in the schedule and that it didn't feel like a real Zen retreat. And I just want to say, for my money, you are truly in the right place. Better to have your heart opened and filled with life than to get super stoned from sitting a lot. And part of the point is that it is soft here. And finding that softness is a very important part of practice. For it is when we are soft that we can more easily break through our hard shells. And as Hang Shi puts it, wander into the circle of wonder. When we are soft, we can more easily get to the center, the core. As my 94-year-old piano teacher would say, the center controls the periphery. It could never be the other way. The tail can't wag the dog. When we turn up the heat, so to say, by getting softer, it allows us to go deeper. Instead of pushing, we can release and sink into it. And maybe then, in the center, in the core, we can have a look at this original face that Shinryu Sensei was speaking of the other day. So there was a point in Shinryu Sensei's talk that struck me. He said, at one point, he said that the point of our zazen wasn't to build up a lot of concentration and have a blowout samadhi experience. And when he said that, we all laughed. The whole room burst into laughter. I laughed. And that's a point I've heard expressed and met with laughter quite a bit in talks. But this time I thought to myself, why do we laugh at that? I wondered, why is that funny? What is funny or ridiculous about that notion? Is it because we are so elevated in our practice that we know such a notion is ridiculous? Maybe it was just a nervous session, jittery response. I don't know. Why did you laugh? If I'm honest with myself, looking back to when I started practice, or looking back at the first retreat I did 11 years ago at that Rinzai temple, I think I probably had a lot of ideas like that. I was looking for freedom, for healing, and this idea of enlightenment or samadhi blowouts had some kind of promise for that, be it false as it may have been. When I stepped back and shined the light inside, as Dogen instructs, I didn't think what I was looking at was the bright, boundless field at all. Quite the opposite. I was looking to get rid of whatever that shit was that I was shining the light on And I wanted the stuff, all this good, bright, boundless stuff in its place. Samadhi, enlightenment. That was what I wanted to get. I certainly was looking for that samadhi explosion, to experience a preconceived idea of freedom that I was desperately looking for. And that's why I came to practice. Maybe some of you can remember the reasons you started to come to practice. Was there the awareness that the idea of a samadhi blowout was a ridiculous notion? I actually think that the desire to want some kind of experience like that is very tender and very sweet. And maybe it is still in us a little bit. And I think it's very sweet and innocent. Of course, the more we practice, we see that this is indeed quite the bittersweet joke of Zen. Because what we have wanted all along has always been there. But, like Soshin told us yesterday, it's not how we expected it. We're not going to get rid of it, but it is the exact thing we've been looking for. All along, it's been right under our noses. Hongxi said, "We all have the clear, wondrously bright field from the beginning. Many lifetimes of misunderstanding come only from distrust, hindrance, and screens of confusion that we create in a scenario of isolation. With boundless wisdom, journey beyond this, forgetting accomplishments. Straightforwardly abandon stratagems and take on responsibility. Having turned yourself around, accepting your situation, if you set foot on the path, spiritual energy will marvelously transport you." So in here is this idea that seeing what is actually there, being honest with yourself, and taking responsibility for that can be very healing. Spiritual energy will marvelously transport you. But again, reading this statement might sound like the clouds will part and a ray of light will come down and carry you up to heaven. But it's actually saying that it has always been there from the beginning. And just through distrust, hindrance, and screens of confusion, we have failed to see it. When you can see past this confusion and see who you actually are, then you are transported. Then you are healed. So this reminds me again of the filmmakers from Italy after World War II. Italian films before this time were more of a fantasy epic dramas that were essentially an escape from reality. These neo-realist filmmakers wanted to make movies about what they actually saw: poverty, suffering, loss. In neo-realism, for the first time, illusion took the back seat to reality. The idea was being honest with what you see and letting it heal you. We heal by presenting the clear, unembellished truth. And this is very apparent in a film by the great Federico Fellini called La Strada. Any of you have ever seen that? It's an early film of Fellini's, so it's not so abstract and hard to understand. It's a very simple story. It's a story of a woman named Gelsomina, who was played by Julieta Messina, who's Fellini's wife, and she's amazing. She's like the Italian Charlie Chaplin. And she plays a young woman that is very childlike, full of innocence, full of life. And she's basically bought. Her family, who was very poor and struggling to get by, end up selling her to this man, played by Anthony Quinn, named Zampano. Zampano is a very, very brutal man. Angry at the world, very violent man. He's a traveling performer. He's a traveling strong man, and he always does this thing where part of his show is that he puts this chain around his chest and he goes, breaks the chain open. So Zampano takes Gelsomina with him in his little cart, and they travel on the road. That's what La Strada means, the road. And throughout their journeys, you see all the terrible conditions that are happening in the country post-war, the poverty and all the destruction. But also, they are going to weddings, they're stopping at carnivals, celebrations. And Gelsomina really loves her new life. She kind of falls in love with Zampano also, even though what he represents. But she's getting to travel and see the world. And eventually they end up at this circus and they meet the third kind of core character in the story, who is the fool. And he's like the classic comedic character. And he can't stop teasing Zampano. As you might imagine, the fool and Gelsomina get along. They get along very well. And they like to play and laugh and frolic around together. This fool sees the absurdity of life, and he cannot take Zampano seriously. But Zampano takes himself very seriously. And he's become too hardened and too world-weary to fall in love or to laugh at himself. Ultimately, he murders the fool. The fool keeps pushing him so much that he ends up killing him. And with that, he kills the spirit that was in Gelsomina. Whatever joy she had in life at that point was destroyed. The story goes on. They end up parting ways. And he leaves her. And at the end of the film, you see that he realizes that he had love. It was right there, and it was gone. And in the closing scene, he breaks down and cries on the beach. This is Martin Scorsese talking about the movie. He knows he had it. He was capable of love, and his violence and his anger stamped it out. But his cry of pain at the end of the movie is a breakthrough for him as a character, a kind of redemption. It's just a cry from that very dark, dark place. A place where you have to do battle with yourself and ultimately find redemption through love. It relates directly to the Franciscan element in neorealism, the teachings of Saint Francis of Assisi. Because the compassion that he is talking about in this film is not just for Gelsomina. We have that. Not just for the fool, we know that, but also for Zampano, for the good and the bad. You feel for him at the end. Why end on him? That's the tough place to go to, where your heart goes out to him. That Franciscan element of neorealism, compassion for every living being. In some ways, I think we can identify with all three of these characters. In some ways, I can relate to Gelsomina's innocence, her sweetness, with that sweet innocence, that sweet innocent part that wants to experience the freedom of an enlightenment or a samadhi experience. She has this way of seeing the wonder in everything, and wants to connect with everyone. It kind of reminds me of this innocent view of what we imagine practice will offer us before we come. So when we shine the light inwards, the Gelsomina-like qualities we may see are easy to identify and be compassionate with. But what about our own Zampano-like qualities? Can we see them without separating and also be compassionate and see them as part of the bright, boundless field? Just like Joni Mitchell says, will you take me as I am? Will you? Will you take me as I am? And what about the Zampanos of the world? Like Roshi reminded us with her tree metaphor, we're all leaves on this one great tree. Do we disconnect when we see racism, bigotry, hatred, and violence? Do we see these things as the whole of something we are part of? Or do we make it other? That's not part of my tree. Like Marty says, that's the tough place to go, where your heart goes out to the brutality that causes so much suffering. And when we can be compassionate with these qualities in ourselves, then we can be compassionate with these qualities in others. It all starts right here. And I think a big reason that we are all here, whether we realize it or not, is to look at these tough parts. Because the clear, unembellished truth has the power to heal us. Again, straightforwardly abandon stratagems and take on responsibility. Having turned yourself around, accepting your situation, if you set foot on the path, spiritual energy will marvelously transport you. And then comes in the magic that I see of Zen practice. We can just let it all go. We can just drop it and come back to what is right here and right now. Come back to our breath. Come back to now. A constant flow and cycle of relative and absolute. We can look at these tough places and just see them. And then with an exhale, just let it go. Hongzhi says, the one who sticks out his broad, long tongue transmits the inexhaustible lamp, radiates the great light, and performs the great Buddha work. From the first, not borrowing from others, one atom from outside the Dharma. I really like this image of sticking a tongue out. It really screams to me, let it go. Freely sticking out your tongue, like babies do. And I was also reminded of that great picture of Einstein sticking his tongue out. And it also made me think of this koan. Joshu's washing the bowl. A monk said to Joshu, I have just entered this monastery. I beg you to teach me. Joshu asked, have you eaten your rice gruel? I have, replied the monk. Then, said Joshu, go and wash your bowls. The monk was enlightened. In Mumon's commentary, he says, Joshu opened his mouth and showed his gallbladder, his heart, and his liver. I imagine he also showed his tongue. And also, notice how soft he is in his response. Just wash your bowls. Can we be this direct? Can we be this compassionate? And can we be this soft with ourselves? So as we go deeper into this session, I invite you all to wander into the circle of wonder with your tongue hanging out and letting it all go, letting it all hang out, exposing everything, all of your insides, your gallbladder even. Letting things come and go, softly playing like a baby. Seeing everything that is there. Just being everything that shows up before you. The mist in the field this morning. The sound of the fans. The sound of the birds and the crickets. The heat. The sweat dripping. The aches and pains. The sadness and joy. Just be all of it. Letting it flow in and out without attaching and without grasping. Roshi showed us so clearly last night when she said, listen to the bell. Right now, listen.